I'm not actually going to preach on the passage, but I thought we ought to have it since it's what I was given as the heading, as it were, for today. My topic is baptism and mission, and at first I was wrestling with this because I couldn't quite see how these two things fitted together. But when you step back and you see the big picture, that's when they fit together. So what I'm trying to do this morning really is to give us that sense of the big picture. Now, I'm taking two risks here, partly because this is the first time I've used PowerPoint in a sermon, and secondly, it's the first time I've used PowerPoint and not been able to see and control the slides myself. But Laura seems to know what she's doing, so we're going to hope that this all works out well. I'm sure it will. Stepping back to see the big picture means we need to ask the question, what is the mission that we're called to? What is the mission of the church? And that means asking, what is God's mission in this world? Because that is the mission of the church. And to answer that and to see the big picture, we need to go right back to the beginning. So the story begins in Genesis, when God first makes human beings, he blessed them. God blessed them and said, "Fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and everything that moves upon the face of the earth." God's original purpose was to bless humanity and that humanity should spread over this globe. And in doing that, should know God's blessing. Unfortunately, as we all know, the blessing is rejected. The blessing is rejected through the first act of disobedience in Genesis 3, which then gives rise to the first murder in Genesis 4. And by the end of Genesis 4, with the story of Lamech, we know that violence and murder in the earth have escalated. The result is that by Genesis 6, people do fill the earth, but they fill it with violence. And so, human dominion, the dominion we're called to exercise, human dominion is distorted. And Genesis 6, in a translation I prefer, says, "The earth was ruined in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was ruined, for all humanity had ruined its journey on the earth." Ruined, ruined, ruined. And so the flood is sent as a punishment and as a cleansing of the ruined earth. The flood signals a fresh beginning, but with the same humanity. And so there is no improvement after the flood. I'm just going to check. Yes, we're keeping up. That's great. There's no improvement after the flood. God says in Genesis 8 that the imagination of the human heart is still evil from youth onwards. There's been no change in the human condition. And so it's not surprising that a very short time afterwards we come to the story of the Tower of Babel. They said, "Let us make a name for themselves." Instead of spreading over the earth, as humanity was supposed to do, these people band together to make a name for whom? For themselves. And so God has to scatter them. Things are not getting any better, but God does not give up. I don't know if you've noticed when you've read through those early chapters of Genesis, but every sin has its punishment, but every punishment has its mitigating act of God's grace. When Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, God's grace is still shown in the fact that he provides them with proper clothes made from animal skins to replace their own pathetic attempts to cover themselves with leaves. When Cain has killed Abel and his punishment is that he's cut off from the earth, Nevertheless, God places a mark on him that will protect him from vengeance. When God sends the flood, he doesn't wipe out everything and begin with a new creation, but his act of grace is that he preserves enough of everything for a new start. But when we get to the story of the Tower of Babel, where is that corresponding act of grace? It might seem as though God has given up, because there is no corresponding act of grace to the punishment of scattering people over the earth. But in fact, God does not give up, because the corresponding act of grace is to call Abraham. Now the Lord said to Abraham, "Go to the land I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. And in you all the families, literally all the kin groups of the earth, shall be blessed." And it's a promise that gets repeated in various places to Isaac and to Jacob. This is the corresponding act of grace, but it's very different. It's very surprising. Previously, God's been dealing with the whole of humanity on a global scale. But now, it's as though it's like a film director decides that we're going to zoom in. A zoom lens is going to come into action and take us down into some detailed piece of the action, which is quite different from what we've seen before. The surprising response to the Tower of Babel is to call one man and his family. And it looks at first as though this has taken a totally different tack, because instead of dealing with the whole earth, God has just chosen one man from whom he's going to make a special nation for himself. Does that mean God's given up on the rest? No, because right at the beginning, there in Genesis 12, 1-3, there's the emphasis that the whole point of this creation of this people through Abraham is that in you all the kin groups of the earth shall be blessed. The tactic has changed, but the aim is still the same, that all humanity shall be blessed. And so we could say that Abraham is the beginning of God's rescue plan. The beginning of God's rescue plan. And Chris Wright, whose words I hope are there, yes, says a new world, ultimately a new creation, begins in this text. And as we know, the nation does come to be. It comes to be in slavery in Egypt. But then it's called out of slavery and led to Sinai. So the exodus from Egypt marks the point where God's people become a nation. And this is the first time that they're actually called a nation. But they're no ordinary nation. "Now therefore," says God, "now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." What does that phrase mean? A priestly kingdom. Let's dwell on that a moment. A priestly kingdom. This is what Israel is called to be. What was the role of a priest in the Old Testament? Well, it was a role that faced two ways. In teaching the people, you were representing God to the people. In offering the sacrifices in the tabernacle or the temple, you were representing the people to God. And so what is this priestly kingdom to be? Israel is called to be God's people on behalf of the whole earth. And so we see here in this phrase an echo of that call of Abraham, that through him, through his descendants, all the kin groups of earth shall be blessed. This is a people called not just to be a people for their own benefit. They're not the people of God for their own sake. They're to be the people of God ultimately for the sake of the world, because they are to display God's character in the way they behave, the way they live out their communal life, in every area of life, in politics, in their religion, in their personal lives, the way they farm the land, the way they care for the widows and the orphans and the foreigners in the country. in everything they do, they are to reflect the character of God. And so they are to display God's character to the whole earth. That's part of what it means to be a priestly kingdom. But of course, it's not that simple. The story goes awry yet again. Right at the beginning, the golden calf incident. 10 commandments have barely been given when the people turn aside. And we know right from that point that this is not going to be an easy journey for this people called to display God's character to the world. And the history of the next few centuries is a history of tribes behaving badly. The book of Judges uses the phrase a number of times that in those days there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that phrase leads us to hope that when a king arrives, things will be different. A king sounds like the answer because people are behaving like this because there is no king. Kings do arrive, but sadly, kings don't stop the rot. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to go through the whole history of the monarchy in Israel. I'm just going to remind you that during that history, a recurring theme is of prophets arising to condemn the kings for not leading the people in the right way. The condemnation of the prophets, which builds up to the condemnation that I hope is on the screen from Jeremiah. And now, because you've done all these things, says the Lord, when I spoke to you persistently and you did not listen, I will cast you out of my sight. This recurring disobedience leads eventually to the exile. Jerusalem is destroyed, and the people are in exile in Babylon for about 50 years. Is this then the end? No, God has still not given up. They are still God's servant people with a mission. And the mission is now clarified to them while they are in exile. Just take in these words. I've given you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison those who sit in darkness. This is the mission of Israel. This is the mission of God's servant people. But for God's servant people, it is mission impossible. Because alongside those words, in the same chapter, Isaiah 42, we have these words. Who is blind but my servant? This is a people robbed and plundered. All of them are trapped in holes and hidden in prisons, a prey with no one to rescue. Just look at those two passages side by side. Look at what Israel is called to do to the nations, and then look at what Israel is in this situation. They are to be a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon. And yet, servant Israel is blind. Servant Israel is in prison. In other words, how can Israel be the servant when Israel has got itself into exactly the same fix as the people to whom it is supposed to minister? But it is still God's servant people. How is this mission to be accomplished? And it seems as you read through the remainder of the book of Isaiah that this mission, although it cannot be accomplished by Israel as a nation, it is going to devolve on somebody who will fulfill that mission. The mission of Israel will be fulfilled. You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. It's too light a thing you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light to the nations. This is a very mysterious passage. You are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. And yet, the mission of Israel seems to devolve upon someone who is and isn't Israel. someone who represents that mission of Israel, and yet who is distinct from Israel to the extent that their mission is to raise up the tribes of Israel, and then to go beyond that and be a light for the nations. The figure of the servant starts off at the beginning of the book being quite clearly Israel, but as it goes on, it becomes quite unclear who is to be this servant. Is it to be Israel? Apparently, yes. Or is it to is the mission to devolve on somebody else who will represent Israel? Apparently, that's yes as well. So we're left wondering who this mysterious servant is to be. That through this servant, God's salvation will reach to the ends of the earth. Well, of course, with the benefit of our Christian hindsight, we know that Jesus is the true Israel, that Jesus is the true servant, the one who fulfills perfectly in his life the mission of Israel. He doesn't replace Israel, he is Israel. He embodies the mission, the purpose, the destiny of Israel. This explains so many of the little mysterious things about the way the gospel writers tell the story of Jesus. Like Matthew, when Jesus as a baby has been taken into Egypt to avoid being killed by Herod, and when they come out again, Matthew says, "Thus it was written by the prophet, 'Out of Egypt have I called my son.'" Have you ever looked at where that verse comes from? It's Hosea 11, verse 1. Hosea is not predicting a future event. He's talking about the Exodus. He's looking back to the Exodus. So in what sense then is this a verse about Jesus? It's not a prediction, it's not a prophecy about a future event at all. In what sense does Jesus coming out of Egypt fulfill this word of Hosea? It's because Jesus in his person, in his life, sums up the mission, the destiny, the purpose of Israel. Israel was 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness. Israel repeatedly failed its tests in the wilderness. Jesus is mightily victorious. And I could go on picking all sorts of things out. The gospel writers use quite deliberately to show us that Jesus is summing up and fulfilling the mission of Israel. He is, if you like, Israel embodied, just as much as he is God embodied. And so many of the little songs that Luke includes at the beginning of his gospel are designed to show us this link between Jesus and Old Testament Israel. That's why in the Song of Simeon, which I hope is still, yes, we have words that echo those words about the servant in Isaiah, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for the glory of your people Israel. But Jesus is more even than that. He is the beginning of a new creation. So Paul, years after that conversion experience we heard about in our reading, can write, "He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead." A new creation begins with Jesus. And this is the beginning of our story. This is the beginning of our story. But it's not a clean break with what's gone before. In many ways, our story is the continuation of the story of Israel. So that same St. Paul, whose mission was to go to the Gentiles and to kings and to the people of Israel, St. Paul can write in his letter to the Galatians, speaking primarily to a Gentile congregation, he can say, "If you are Christ's, you are children of Abraham, heirs according to the promise." This is an extraordinary thing to say, because no Jew of the time would have said of a Gentile that they were children of Abraham. They could be God-fearers, they could commit themselves to keeping the law, but you are not supposed to call a Gentile a child of Abraham. But Paul does it in this letter. He says, "You, Gentile converts, are children of Abraham, heirs according to the promise. And they are therefore members of what later in that letter he calls the Israel of God, this enlarged Israel, which is no longer just Jewish believers in Jesus, but the Gentile believers as well. This was his mission, to proclaim God's message before Gentiles, kings, and the people of Israel. And this means then that it's not so much a change of plan as an enlargement of the plan. This Israel of God is an upgraded Israel that now includes Gentiles among its number. But notice another thing about this. Paul has obviously spent time teaching these Gentiles about the Old Testament scriptures. It would mean nothing to them to say you're children of Abraham unless they had by this time learnt their Old Testament scriptures. Becoming part of this people of God means you immerse yourself in their story, because you have been grafted in, to use the phrase he uses in Romans, you've been grafted into this people, you are now part of this story. So learn this story, know where you've come from. This story is now your story. You are children of Abraham, heirs according to the promise. And so, we need the diagram. Yes, thank you. Jesus sums up the mission, the destiny, the purpose of Israel. You could think of it, if you like, as Jesus as a righteous remnant of one. Jesus, the faithful Israelite, living out what Israel was always called to do. But it doesn't stop there. Next one. Because it goes on to expand beyond this Jesus who fulfilled the mission of Israel. It spreads out again to become the mission of the church. We are to continue the mission of Israel. I want you to notice this verse from later on in the book of Acts, where Saul and Barnabas have been to the synagogue in Antioch of Pisidia. It's always Paul's practice to go first to the synagogue, if there is one, in any town he visits. And if the Jews reject his message, then he goes to the Gentiles. And he says to the Jews of this particular place, okay, we're now going to go to the Gentiles, because you've not wanted to listen to this. For so the Lord has commanded us, saying, I have made you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring salvation to the ends of the earth. Do you notice what he's doing? He's quoting one of those verses about the servant's mission and applying it to himself and Barnabas. He's applying it to the mission of the early church. So the mission that was originally the mission of Israel, which was faithfully fulfilled by Jesus, is now the mission of the church. It's the same mission, to be a light for the Gentiles, to bring salvation to the ends of the earth. You might think, well, he's gone on for nearly 25 minutes. He's said very little about baptism and mission. But now, I hope you can begin to see the connection, and let me pull it together. By baptism, we become members of the servant people of God. By baptism, we become members of the servant people of God. That's what we're baptized into when we're baptized into the church. And the servant people of God is a people charged with a mission. And that mission is to bring salvation to the ends of the earth. That mission is to fulfill the mission of God on this earth, which is that all the families of the earth should be blessed. That's been God's mission right from the very beginning. It's still God's mission, and it's the mission we are baptized into. It's the mission that we inherit. And that means we need to take very seriously things Jesus says to us, like, you are the light of the world. We should be on the last slide now. And we are, thank you. You're doing a great job there. It's wonderful. Jesus is said to be the light of the world in John's Gospel. Again, picking up the imagery from those passages about the servant in Isaiah. A light to the Gentiles. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. But he also says to his disciples, you are the light of the world. Remember the diagram where the lines came together to Jesus and then spread out again. We carry on that mission. We are the light of the world. And then 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter deliberately echoing what God says to Israel in Exodus 19 says to the Christian church, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood. There's that phrase again, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. And then he gives it his own distinctive twist, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Whenever we read passages like this, and I could multiply these endlessly, please notice that the verbs in these passages are plural. The you is you plural. It's you all, not you singular. In the West, we've tended to individualize the Christian faith. We tend to think it's all about individual holiness, individual morality, individual witness. And all those things are important. Yes, individual holiness does matter, of course. But what God is about creating a missionary people. A people who by our common life, by the way we relate to each other, the way we live as communities, display something of God's character to the world. Just as Israel was meant to do it. Just as Israel was constituted to do by the law at Sinai. We are called by our life together in community to display God's character, God's values, and God's standards to the world. Now, of course, that can't be done unless we as individuals are all committed and we all know Jesus personally and we all have made his values and his priorities our own. But we're not really fulfilling the mission of God unless we're doing it as communities. This must be reflected in our common life. And it's a great challenge to the individualism of Western society and often of Western Christianity. We are baptized into a missionary people. We're not baptized so we can go off and be missionary individuals. We're baptized into a missionary people, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, that we, together, collectively, as communities, might declare, not just by our words, but by the way we live, might declare the wonderful deeds of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. Amen.